Okay. Well, good morning, everybody. I am really delighted to be here. I'm especially delighted to be here as a speaker and an attendee and not as general chair. And I'm really grateful to Mez, who on short notice, you know, in the middle of the year when I said, I'm going to the FTC and they're not going to let me do this anymore. And Mez stepped in and took over and did a really great job. So thank you, Mez. Yang mentioned my kids. Those of you who've been coming to Soups for a while probably remember seeing my kids at Soups chasing after me or me carrying them around. Well, they've gotten a lot bigger. They are becoming teenagers now, so they're not here. They are at camp. Okay, so what would I like to talk about today? I'm going to talk about public policy and how usable privacy and security researchers can get involved in public policy. I'm going to focus on what I've been doing at the Federal Trade Commission for the past 5 months, and in particular four projects which I've blogged about, and I'll tell you kind of behind the scenes more than what's in the blog post. And I'll talk about some opportunities for you all to get involved at the FTC and other places where your work can have an impact on public policy. So how did I get started? Well, I went to Washington University in St. Louis, and I got a doctoral degree in engineering and policy. So it was policy related, but I also got a master's degree in computer science along the way. And I did research in electronic voting, and I volunteered to teach a class on computers and society. And along the way, I took the one HCI class that was offered at the university. And I didn't really know what it was I was going to do after that, but I thought maybe something related to internet policy. In 1996, I graduated, and I joined AT&T Labs Research in New Jersey. And they just started a new public policy research department. There were two other members, which some of you may know, Paul Resnick, who's now at the University of Michigan, and Brian Lamacchia, who's now at Microsoft. So the three of us were the public policy research department, trying to figure out what that was exactly. And I'd been there a few weeks, and there was a meeting in Washington, D.C. of something called the Internet Privacy Working Group. And Paul suggested that I go to this meeting. And I went down there, and it was a room full of mostly lawyers. And they wanted to do this project where they would come up with computer-readable privacy policies. And they had this vision that your web browser could negotiate with websites over privacy and do it in this seamless way in the background, and everything would be really nice for users. And so they asked me if I wanted to be involved. And I thought, oh, you know, this could be fun to work on for a few months. So I got involved, the World Wide Web Consortium adopted the project. It became the P3P project. I became chair of the working group, and I worked on it for about 6 years. Before the first release was 6 years, it was even more than that. Also, while I was at AT&T, another thing that they were very interested in that was public policy related was how to protect children on the internet. So that was another area that I got involved in. And I had a lot of opportunities to work with policymakers to speak on Capitol Hill on both the privacy issues and the child protection issues. And I learned a lot about privacy. I hung out with a lot of corporate lawyers and law professors, and I learned a lot about U.S. privacy law as well as international privacy law, self-regulation, and all of the kind of politics around privacy. And I also learned a lot about international diplomacy in the process, which was sort of the last thing I thought I would be doing as, you know, an engineering graduate. But you know, you walk into a meeting and everybody has those headsets for simultaneous translation, and there are all these like protocols, and it was a really interesting experience. In the year 2000, the Federal Trade Commission convened a advisory committee on online access and security, and so they invited me to participate in this, and there were about 40 people, again, mostly lawyers, And we had 3 months to come up with a report on what the FTC should do about advising companies on online access and security. So we ended up having 4 full-day meetings over a 3-month period in Washington. It was really intense, but really interesting. And I got to work with staffers at the FTC, as well as people from corporate privacy groups and advocacy groups and some academics. And I still have the t-shirt that they gave us at our last meeting. So P3P, as I mentioned, I worked on for about 6 years, and finally in 2002, we actually issued our standard a long time after we'd started in 1996. And it was definitely a slow and painful process, but a really good learning experience. And one of the things that I learned in the process is that this standard, as with most W3C standards, was really focused on the interoperability of P3P, you know, the language, the protocol. And I realized that if P3P was going to be useful, it had to have user agent tools for end users. And I wanted to know, what are those going to look like? How can we make P3P something useful for users? And nobody was really working in that area. So I asked my management at AT&T to fund a project to develop a P3P user agent. And they agreed, and they put me in charge of it. And I had never designed software or user interfaces before, except for that one HCI class that I took in grad school. So I went and I talked to the HCI group at AT&T. And at the time, it was great, because we had so many really outstanding computer scientists in like any area. If you needed expertise, you could find them in the building. And then I went and did a literature review on how you make privacy tools usable. And I came up with pretty much nothing. And so I worked on the project, but I also thought, wow, this is like this untapped area and something that even beyond this project, I could work on. So I developed this tool called Privacy Bird. And it put this green bird icon in the corner of your browser to show that the websites had privacy policies that match your preferences. And I guess if I plug in the sound, you can hear, you're gonna hear the privacy bird sound. There you go, privacy bird sound, that's the happy bird. there was also an angry bird sound if it didn't match your privacy preferences, but it's very startling, I won't play that. And we also had a search engine version where your search results could be annotated with privacy birds. So that was a really interesting project, but also, again, a real learning experience in understanding some of the issues with developing privacy tools that are usable. At the end of 2003, I left AT&T and I went to Carnegie Mellon as a faculty member. And in my first semester there, I developed and taught a course called Privacy Policy, Law, and Technology. And basically, my goal was to teach the students everything I'd learned about privacy while working on P3P. And it was fun and intense. I also started writing grant proposals, and I pitched a bunch of projects related to usable privacy and security. I said, this is a really fascinating research area. Not much has been done in it. Let's do some research. And I started the CUPS lab, the CMU Usable Privacy and Security Lab. By 2007, I had lots of students all doing lots of really cool things. And you may recognize some of those people who have all graduated. The students were interested in doing some work with P3P and with Privacy Bird. And I talked to one of the research managers at AT&T, and I convinced them to liberate Privacy Bird, and they actually donated Privacy Bird to Carnegie Mellon, and so we were able to continue working on it. And we did a number of research studies with Privacy Bird and Privacy Finder, including one where we demonstrated that if you put that privacy information right in search results, some people will actually pay more to buy things from websites with better privacy policies. This was a paper done with Alessandro Acquisti, Serge Egelman, Janice Tsai, and others. And this was a really influential paper because it was one of the first demonstrations that actually people do care about privacy. You know, there are a lot of trade-offs to be made, but if you can get rid of some of that friction that really makes it difficult to act on your privacy preferences, then people will actually act on them. Another influential and very well-cited paper was a paper that I did with Alicia McDonald. Alicia had come into my office one day and she said, what do you think would happen if everybody read privacy policies at websites? And I said, Alicia, don't be ridiculous. Nobody's going to read privacy policies at websites. And she says, yeah, but what if they did? Like, how much time would it take? Yeah, good question. So as with many of my papers, the best papers come from these crazy ideas the students come in with. And so she went and got the data about how long privacy policies were and what the average adult reading speed was and all sorts of other things. And she came up with 244 hours per year, which is a completely ridiculous number. Like, nobody is going to spend 244 hours per year reading privacy policies. And so we published this, and it's gotten a lot of attention, and especially because of that number in it. We also did some work on designing privacy nutrition labels, and this is work with Patrick Kelly and others. The idea here was that, you know, nutrition labels are a nice succinct way of talking about what's in food. Can we do something similar for privacy? We did an iterative design process. We did a lot of testing of them. And in this picture, I was talking about them at a briefing for congressional staff. So this, again, is something that has gotten policy attention. In 2012, we did some works about some work on the perception of online behavioral advertising. We had actually two papers, one at CHI and one at SUPS, that were related. And these papers were recognized by the Future of Privacy Forum, and they put together a booklet called Privacy Papers for Policymakers. And it's pretty cool because not only do they recognize you and you get to go to this fancy place where everybody has to put their suits on, but it's such a rare thing. But they put together this booklet, which they distribute to congressional offices with the executive summaries of these research papers. So it's good exposure on Capitol Hill for your research. All right, so I mentioned, you know, I spent all these years working on P3P for standardized privacy policies, but in the end, P3P didn't actually get widely adopted. But one of the things that we noticed was there was this new privacy policy for banks that was in a standard format, and it was seeing some widespread adoption. Susan Kleiman, who's here, worked on that at the FTC as a consultant to the FTC on developing this standard notice. So we did a project where we went and made a web crawler that looked for these standard bank privacy policies and collected them all. And we had over 6,000 of them. And we were able to analyze them and see trends in bank privacy notices. And then we said, wow, we have all this data. Let's make it available to people. And so we built a bank search engine, which is on our website. And you can look up, you know, by zip code and find out what banks are in that zip code and compare their privacy policies. And this is something that we shared with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as well. Right, last year at SUPS, we had a paper which Florian Chaub presented. And it's called A Design Space for Privacy Notices. And this was also recognized by the Future of Privacy Forum in their Privacy Papers for Policymakers. And you can see there's Rebecca Balibacco and Adam Durity with Florian on a panel that FPF put together. And then in January, I started at the FTC. And when I started there, a lot of people asked me, what are you going to be doing? And I said, I had no idea, but it will be fun. And it has been. And I still don't completely know what I do, but I'm going to try to tell you a little bit about it and some of the things that I've been working on. So to start with, here are some of the people that I work with. So the FTC is supposed to have 5 commissioners. We had 4 when I started. Julie Brill actually left a few months ago, so now we have 3 commissioners. We also have 3 bureaus, which are the main divisions of the agency. So we have the Bureau of Consumer Protection, which is where most of the privacy and security work occurs. We also have the Bureau of Competition. They deal with a lot of mergers and acquisitions, antitrust, things like that. And then we have the Bureau of Economics. So most of the FTC is lawyers, but the Bureau of Economics is economists. And there are a lot of people who do actually economics research in that bureau. I work in the office of the chairwoman, which is a really kind of cool place to be. Officially, I'm supposed to be advising the chairwoman, and I do spend some time reviewing documents that are coming out of her office, providing input into pending actions and things like that. But the chairwoman actually wants me to get involved in the whole agency, and so I look for things that interest me, and I go work with people across the agency. Within the agency, a lot of people really only stick within their division. So it's kind of a unique position to be able to work across all of the different divisions in the agency. Now, the other thing that I want to point out, some of you may have noticed, so those of you in computer science, how unusual to have all these women in leadership roles. So it has been delightful working in an agency where the majority of the leaders are actually women. We do have some men who are not in the picture too, but most of the leadership actually are women right now. All right. The FTC started a new office about a year ago called the Office of Technology Research and Investigation. It goes by OTEC. OTEC is within our Bureau of Consumer Protection and has the role of supporting the cases that have technology issues, which are a lot of them. It's very small and so can't actually even support everything that's going on. We currently have about 10 people, including 3 summer interns. Gives you an idea of the scale. We're in the process of hiring a permanent director. We did recently hire a research coordinator who is Joe Calandrino. Some of you may know him. And that's an organization that I'm not in that group, but I work very closely with them and spend a lot of time with the OTEC folks. All right, so this is the hallway where my office is in the FTC headquarters building. It's one of these classic 100-year-old Washington, D.C. buildings. One thing I want to highlight here is the door and the door lock. Some of you know from my past SUPS work many years ago with Lujo Bauer and Cami Vanier, we have a thing for door locks, and we've done some research in this area. So this door lock is really interesting because it's an old door, and the lock is supposed to look like a lock on an old door, but it's really an electronic lock. And it has this really funny key. Yeah, the key has an emoticon on it. So right now, this emoticon, that is in the neutral state. I like to call it the grumpy state. And your door will not unlock unless you get that emoticon into the happy state. But the thing is, even if it's in the happy state, it still won't unlock. And I like to think of it as it's just laughing at me. And it's smiling, and I'm shaking the door, and the damn thing won't actually unlock. And it's got like this pressure-sensitive thing. And the way it's supposed to work is you put your thumb into that little groove. It senses that you're holding the key. And if it's a door you're allowed to unlock, then it goes happy, and you unlock it. But the thing is, these keys are all old. And so in my case, the trick is actually that you have to hold the key on the side and not put your finger in the place you're supposed to put your finger. And if you do that very carefully, then the door might unlock for you. Other people have told me they have to put their key upside down so they can't see the emoticon, and then their door will unlock. What actually happens is that most people have stopped locking their doors, which probably comes as no surprise to people in the usable security community that would be the effect. I wanted to find out more about these keys, so I looked at the manufacturer and I looked them up. And the first thing that came up on my search result was that about 8 years ago, they'd been hacked at DEF CON. So not only are they not usable, they're also not secure. But you have to go through security to get into the building, so I guess we're OK. Right. Um, All right. So besides the keys, there's been other FTC technology, which has been driving me a little nuts. So as you can see, I'm a Mac user. I come to the FTC, and I have to use Windows 7. I don't know how to use Windows 7. I don't know how to use Outlook, which everybody uses the FTC. But that's okay. The first day, there was computer training. Yay! So I go to computer training, and they're supposed to be doing voicemail, Outlook, and security awareness. And the trainer, the first thing he says is, we're going to skip the voicemail and Outlook training, and we're just going to do security awareness. All right, this is a really bad decision. And by the end of it, I think we both agreed that this is a really bad decision. They wouldn't let me actually log into my email until I'd passed the security training test. And by the time the trainer finished the security awareness training, and then I finished correcting his security awareness training, I had like 35 emails and two meetings that I had missed because I didn't know how to use my Outlook calendar to see that people had put them on my calendar. And but we did get through it. So I kept saying, couldn't I really have a Mac? And no, but they said I could have this really nice iPad with a keyboard, right? So I was happy to have an iPad. It's almost like having a Mac. Well, at least I thought it was, until I found out that we weren't allowed to install apps on it. Not only that, we weren't allowed to actually even use the native apps that were installed on it. We could only use this special, like, high security government app that they had installed on it. And this, on the screen, this is the government note-taking app. The top half of the screen is where you can take notes. The bottom half of the screen is where your virtual keyboard would be if you didn't have a real keyboard. But I have a real keyboard, and I only have half the screen available to me anyway. And every time you open up a blank document, it puts in this sample text, which you then have to delete before you can actually type your actual document. All right, this is the kind of technology I have to deal with. But I'm getting it. I'm getting the hang of it. Okay. So then there were passwords. All right. So everything you do in the government has a different password. Right? You know, we have these PIV cards, which should allow us to go to different government systems and use the same card with passwords and whatnot. But they're not actually interoperable. They should be, but they're not. And so we have all these new passwords we have to create, and they all expire in 60 days. And they all follow different rules. So, like, first I had to, like, to get a background check, and so that system was a 14-character password with at least 3 character classes. And then I had to sign up for the travel system, and that was 12 characters, but with at least 4 character classes. And each one is, like, slightly different. And so this was kind of annoying. And then one day I was looking at the FTC Twitter feed, and the FTC tweets a lot. Like, you should follow them. It's kind of cool. They tweet a lot, and they said, encourage your loved ones to change passwords often, making them strong and unique. And I was like, why the hell are we telling everybody to change their passwords? Why is this a good thing to do? And so I went to find out who tweeted, and it turns out we have PR people who, like, tweet a lot, and we also have a whole division of consumer and business education, and they tweet and blog a lot, and it's actually a really important function of the FTC to do all this public outreach. So I said, but this is the wrong message. And they said, but, you know, the FTC makes us change our passwords every 60 days. It must be good. Yeah. And I said, well, you know, I have a problem with that, too. So they said, well, we're not the ones to be talking to about that. So I went to the CIO and the CISO, and I went and talked to them. They were the right people to talk to about this. And they said, we've been thinking about changing this policy, but we're concerned that if we changed it, people would think that the FTC is going soft on security. And so they said, we really need some evidence that that it's a bad idea to change your password every 60 days. So there's plenty of evidence, thanks to a lot of people in this room who've done research in this area, and I went and I collected this research, and I wrote them a nice executive summary, and I was like, okay, here's your evidence. Can we change this policy? And they were actually convinced. So, I mean, it won't happen overnight, but eventually it's going to happen as part of other changes that are being made in our authentication systems. And so I was like, wow, this is great. I wonder if other people would be convinced. So I wrote a blog post, and I put all this information out. First of all, I proposed to put it out. I had to get it approved. There was some resistance to the FTC saying this publicly, because in the past we have said the opposite. But they eventually approved me saying this. I posted this blog post, and you know, one of the really cool things about being the chief technologist at the FTC is my blogs go on the front page of the FTC website, and there are thousands of people who are subscribed to the Tech at FTC blog, and so a lot of people read it. And a lot of media picked up on it and wrote articles about it. And a lot of people sent this around to their system administrators, and I understand that some other organizations are changing their policies. The British government also blogged about it around the same time. I understand there's some, actually, Soups people who were influential in convincing the British government of this. They had written a report, actually, a few months earlier, saying that it doesn't really make sense to force these regular password changes. So companies have also been making changes. This is the old Microsoft advice to their users: use a strong password, change it often. But they've changed it, and in May they have removed any information about changing your password often from the guidance on their website. NIST is coming out with new guidance. They actually have a really interesting process right now where they've put a sort of a pre-review draft on GitHub, and they are welcoming public input. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about it because I think some of you might be interested in providing input into this. This is a four-part thing. The part that focuses on passwords is the part B, but you might want to look at and comment on all of it. So I want to zoom in on the part about memorized user-chosen secrets, or user-selected passwords. Okay, so there's a bunch of points that they make. I'm summarizing them. So they're recommending passwords be at least 8 characters long, that you allow users to have passwords that are at least 64 characters long, use all printing ASCII characters, and oh my gosh, use spaces, right? And then if a user wants a password more than 64 characters long, don't truncate it. Don't store a hint. Do not prompt for secret questions, like the name of your pet. Do not impose composition rules. So this is probably the most controversial point that NIST makes in this document, and one that some of you may have an opinion about. So they say, don't impose composition rules, but do have a blacklist of common passwords. Do implement a throttling mechanism so that it will limit the number of failed attempts people can have. Then related to my blog post, do not require arbitrary periodic password change, so happy about that. Offer the option for people to actually see their password as they're typing it instead of the asterisks or dots. And then really important, store with salt and slow hash. So anyway, this is up on the NIST website, and I do encourage those of you who have expertise in this area to think about submitting some comments. Okay, another project that I've worked on at the FTC relates to open police data. Right, so this was a topic that I actually knew almost nothing about until I got a phone call from Cindy Southworth, who is part of a really great organization called the National Network to End Domestic Violence. And she said that she'd been working with the White House and the Department of Justice to organize an event. And basically, the way this came about is that the White House has this open police data initiative where they are trying to convince police departments to put out as much data as possible on the internet in open format so people can download and analyze it. So this is a great idea for transparency and getting the communities more involved and having more kind of oversight over the way the police are working in their communities. But a lot of this data has information about crime victims. Cindy and her organization are especially concerned because some of this data has information about the victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. So this is kind of a problem. So the White House and the Department of Justice were organizing an event to talk about it, and she asked if I would come and talk about privacy and de-identification. So I agreed to do it on the condition that they also invite Simpson. Because Simpson is at NIST and had just written this wonderful report about de-identification, and I thought he could speak quite expertly on that. So we both were invited to this event, and we took a look at some of the repositories that had already been released of police data. So this is an example from the City of Dallas Police Department. Now, I've fuzzed out some of it, but if you go to the website, it's not fuzzed out, okay? It's all there. Each row is an incident where someone called 911 and reported a crime. And if you scroll, there's actually lots and lots of columns, including columns for the name and address of the person who reported the crime, who is often the victim. Right, and so the only steps that they seem to have done to try to make this a little bit better is they said, well, we've removed the rows for crimes relating to domestic violence and sexual assault, but it's still a problem because there's still all sorts of other kinds of assault that are in there. They decided that was what they needed to do. So here's a picture at the event. It was at the old executive office building across the street from the White House. Megan Smith, the CTO of the White House, was there. There were lots of people from law enforcement, including some like police chiefs, folks from the DOJ and the White House, and from victims advocacy groups. It was a really interesting event. It was really interesting to hear the different perspectives and to see that the police, they're not experts in data de-identification, right? And yet the White House was saying, put out more data. Try to think about privacy. It was clear that they really weren't well positioned to be doing that. So I wrote a blog post afterwards where I basically took my remarks and turned them into a blog post. Shortly thereafter, there was a Washington Post article. And the Washington Post reporter had read my blog and started digging deeper into it. And so she went back to that Dallas repository of data and started digging into it and discovered that even though they said they had removed the sexual assault victims, they hadn't. And so she found that they were in there, wrote an article in the Washington Post, and the Dallas Police Department very quickly did remove that data from it. It was actually good to see like how quickly we were able to have an impact. Now the longer term impact, which I'm still working on, is that I really think that the White House, as part of this initiative, needs to get people who understand data de-identification and privacy and provide some guidance to police departments so that they know what to do here and not just have like every police department in the country try to figure this out on their own. All right, so the next story I want to tell you about is phone hijacking. And this is something that I didn't even know was a thing until it happened to me. So one evening, I was on my phone listening to my voicemail from my daughter, who sent me this very long and rambling voicemail about how she had soccer tryouts the next day and she didn't have cleats and she wanted to borrow mine. And it cut off right in the middle of the call. And I thought, okay, bad coverage, right? And I walked around, I tried calling back again, didn't work. So I called back on a landline phone, called my daughter. Next morning, pick up my phone, still no coverage, can't make any calls. And then my husband says, hey, my phone doesn't work either. So that was odd. I called my carrier
and said, hey, my phone doesn't work. My husband's phone doesn't work. Yeah, we paid our bill. What's going on? She says, oh, are those your new iPhones that don't work? And I said, no, I have old Android phones. No new iPhones here. And she said, huh, you know, it says in the computer system that you just got new iPhones yesterday. And I was like, well, that would be wrong. And so she said, well, you know, must be a computer glitch. But, you know, in the process, we seem to have bricked your SIMs. So you'll need to go to a phone store and get new SIMs. So on my way to work, I went to a phone store. They were also very puzzled about what happened, but they put a new SIM in my phone, and I was able to make calls again. And then my husband went to a different phone store, and they figured out what happened. And what they said is, oh, it looks like somebody went to an Apple store yesterday and upgraded the phones on your account. And they walked out with two brand new iPhones with your phone numbers, and they're billed to your account. So my husband called me right away and told me this, and I called the fraud department to discuss this issue with them. The first thing the guy in the fraud department did was blame me. And he said, well, someone must have, you know, broken into your online account. And he says, you probably haven't updated the antivirus software on your computer in a while. I decided not to tell him who I was or what I did. I was like, oh, yeah, really? So I said, so what evidence do you have that somebody broke into my online account? He says, well, I see some really suspicious transactions. So then I got worried. Oh, okay, maybe somebody really did. And so I said, well, can you tell me what these suspicious transactions are? And he says, well, somebody added international roaming to your account. I was like, well, yes, I traveled in Europe last month, and I did add international roaming to my account. And so everything that he thought was suspicious was like all stuff I had done. So we finally get past that, and he goes and he starts digging deeper, and he says, oh, somebody went into a phone store and upgraded your phones. I'm like, yes, that's why I called you. Right? So he took the charges off our bill, and he told me I should change my passwords anyway. I did that, and then I work for the FTC, and we have people who do identity theft work at the FTC. So they said, you know, we run identitytheft.gov. Like, just go read that website, and you'll see what you should do. And it's a really good website. So if you are the victim of any kind of identity theft, I highly recommend going to identitytheft.gov. And it will tell you what you need to do and also allow you to report that to the FTC. And it was interesting as I was going through it. So I love this website, but of course there are always a few things that could be better. And so I sat there with my notebook and I was jotted down all the usability problems on the website. And then I sent a long list of them to the guy who runs the website, who I'm sure really appreciated that. No, actually, they have actually already fixed some of the things I sent him, and others, I don't know. But anyway, when you go through it, and it guides you through like what kind of identity theft it is, and then it gives you a checklist, and it gives you all the URLs and phone numbers and everything that you need to go through and complete all the things on the checklist. So, you know, it says you should get a fraud alert and get your credit reports, and so I was able to just like click through to the Experian website and do that. And then it guides you through reporting all the details of what happened to the FTC. And the reason why you should do this is, first of all, when you do it, it compiles all the information into an affidavit, which you can print out and then any time you need to send that to someone to show that you were the victim of identity theft, you have it. But also, it goes into this database that the FTC has to spot trends in identity theft. And so it's really useful for the FTC to get this information. So I filled it out, I got my affidavit, I printed it out, and I took it to my local police station on my corner and actually filed a police report. And all I had to do was like hand them this thing I printed out. The police officer like wrote his badge number on it and signed it, and boom, I had a police report. It also turned out that I'd gotten a data breach notice from an unrelated thing a few weeks earlier, and I hadn't done anything about it, but they promised I could get this identity monitoring service. And so I went and I dug that out and I signed up for it. And so it's actually been nice to be able to get these reports once a month to see if anything else is going on in my accounts. And then a few days later, I got email from this company I'd never heard of called Asurion, telling me that I had signed up for this mobile phone protection for $10.99 a month for each of my phones. And I was like, what is this? And I called my carrier, and it turns out the thief had signed me up. Isn't that nice? It's always good to sign up your stolen phones for a mobile protection plan. I had to discuss that with them. There were several other things that happened. I lost the ability to have voicemail on my phone. And my husband's phone, actually, when they put his phone back together, it had the wrong phone number. There were many phone calls. And every time I talked to my carrier, I said, you know, I'd really like to know more about what exactly happened. Like, what store did this happen in? How did it happen? How would you, like, give somebody else, you know, my phone number? And so I found out that that when you go into a store, you have to actually show a photo ID. And so this person must have a fake ID with my name on it. They might have asked for the last four digits of their social security number, although it's not entirely clear. But they wouldn't tell me where the store was. Like, some people told me, some said, oh, it's in Pennsylvania, some said it was in Atlanta. One actually gave me the address of the store in Atlanta, and I was like really excited, and I went and I looked it up on Google Maps, and there was no store there, so totally bogus. Some said it was an Apple store, some said it wasn't an Apple store, it was just like a, you know, store from my carrier, I don't know. So I complained to some of my friends at the FTC, like, you know, they're giving me the runaround. Some of them said I had to get a subpoena if I wanted that information. So it turns out you don't. Turns out that under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, if you are the victim of identity theft, they have to give you the information. And so the FTC on their website has a template for the letter you can send to request that information. So I followed the template. I included a copy of the affidavit and the police report. So that's why it was good I had the police report, because you have to send that along. But I didn't know where to send it. And I looked on my carrier's website, and there's, like, no address to send them, like, legal documents. They really don't want you to do this, right? So I called them, and they gave me an address. I sent it, and I waited a few weeks, and then it came back. Right? Undeliverable. So I called them again, and they gave me a different address in a completely different state. And I waited, and I still, nothing happened. It didn't come back, but nothing happened. So by this point, I've been talking to all of the carriers about this problem and investigating it with my FTC hat on. And so finally, I just talked to, you know, one of the people I was talking to at my carrier. I was like, okay, so this happened to me, and you guys are not giving me the data. Like, can you do something about it? And so I did finally get the information. And so they actually sent me a copy of the sales receipt, which had the address of the store. It was in Ohio. I looked it up on Google Maps, and it was somewhat cathartic to be like, okay, that was the store where the thief went, right? And they said also that they had followed proper authentication procedures, which I think means they glanced at a photo ID. That wasn't really mine. They wrote down the expiration date on the driver's license. It did not match the one that's on my actual driver's license. And they said that they saw no evidence that the thief did anything except get the phones, so they probably were just trying to sell them as opposed to then, like, trying to use them and run up bills on my account. So I posted about this on Facebook, and my friend Dina, one of my Facebook friends, said the same thing had happened to her the week before. And so that was really bizarre, and I started talking to other people and discovered I knew a handful of people that this happened to, like, within the past few months. So this is actually maybe pretty common. So I wondered, how common is it? Oh, I should also mention that some of the people that I talked to had variations on this. So one person I know, she was an AT&T subscriber, and it happened to her at AT&T, and then a few weeks later, she got a bill from Verizon. She doesn't have a Verizon account. And apparently the thief went in and opened a Verizon account for her. So I started looking for news articles,
There was a TV station here in Denver that had gotten reports from about 50 of their viewers that this had happened with their Verizon accounts. There was this church in North Carolina that somebody billed them $10,000 worth of iPhones to their account. There were some people who've been arrested for using fake IDs and getting iPhones. It's usually iPhones. Occasionally they mention other kinds of phones, but usually iPhones and usually the most expensive models available. This guy got arrested multiple times in different states for the same thing. And then I started looking at overseas news, and it was even scarier. So they talk about something called SIM swap. And here, the objective is not to get free iPhones, but to actually get access to your phone number through your SIM card so that they can access your online bank accounts. And apparently, this is a huge problem in the UK and in South Africa and in the United Arab Emirates and in many other countries. And apparently it's starting to become a problem in the US as well. So then the other thing I wanted to do was to find out, well, how many people have reported this to the FTC? And so I got access to our Consumer Sentinel Network, which is like, you know, super secret and requires even more passwords and stuff to get access to. But when I got access to it, it also has the most terrible front end for database searches that you could imagine. I was able to look over time how many reports were we getting of this compared to the reports of identity theft overall. Now remember, we know that only a very small fraction of people actually report anything to the FTC. The Department of Justice estimates it at 1%, but we don't even know if that's a good number. But here's what I found. So in January 2013, we had about 1,000 incidents reported, and that was about 3% of our total identity theft incidents reported to the FTC. By January 2016, this had more than doubled. Right? So it seems like we were having increases both in number as well as the fraction of identity thefts overall that were related to this mobile phone hijacking. So it seemed like, yeah, this is a thing, and this is a big thing. So I talked to all the mobile carriers and asked them, what were they doing about it? So all of the carriers have the ability to set kind of an extra password on your account. So T-Mobile, they mentioned this on their website, and you can, I guess if you're a T-Mobile subscriber, you can go into their store or call them and set this extra password that someone would have to use before making changes to your account. AT&T has that. You can actually, if you're a subscriber, through their online system, you can make this change. I took a look at that. It was actually interesting looking at their user interface. So every time you log in, you have to provide this extra passcode. But you'll notice that near the bottom, it says, don't ask for my passcode again. So effectively, every time you use it, it prompts you to disable it. And once you check that box, you no longer have this extra protection on your account. So that could use some improvement. Verizon has something similar. Sprint has something similar. I believe Sprint's is actually automatic. You don't have to sign up for it. Right, so after getting all this information, I blogged about it. And you know, I thought I'd gotten a lot of traction with the password blog. Well, I think this one has gotten even more interest, has been picked up again by the press. Lots of press articles, lots of people who are just, you know, amazed that this could actually happen. And then a little while later, I heard about this Black Lives Matter activist, Duray McKesson. He has over 400,000 Twitter followers, and somebody hijacked his Verizon account so that they could hack his Twitter account. And he tweeted about it, of course. So he says, I was hacked today, my Twitter account, 2 email addresses, and my phone. It was not due to passwords. They hacked my phone account itself. At 10:31 a.m., someone called Verizon, impersonating me, and successfully changed my SIM and unsuccessfully attempted to change my phone number. By calling Verizon and successfully changing my phone SIM, the hacker bypassed two-factor verification, which I have on all my accounts. Today, I learned that it's rather easy for someone to call the provider and change your SIM. The hacker got the account verification text. And so this is what they're after. This is how they break into
Twitter, Facebook, and financial accounts through this technique. In some cases, they have to do a little bit more. Sometimes there's also a phishing attack because they need some other piece of information, and so then they use phishing to get it, usually. So this is a problem. And it's a problem because we want security and we want convenience. So if I actually lose my phone or have it stolen or it breaks, I want to be able to walk into my phone store and get a new phone, right? But I don't want, you know, somebody with a fake ID to be able to walk in and get a new phone. So I think we really need to rethink how we're doing this authentication and not rely on, you know, a driver's license as the way we're doing this authentication. And, you know, it seems like there are some obvious things that carriers could do, like, hey, text the phone that you're upgrading. You know, you do have this communication channel. And yes, that won't work if you've lost the phone, but then you could escalate to other types of authentication. I expect there are probably people in this room who know about this and are probably doing research right now on how you can improve this authentication channel. And hopefully the carriers will get with it and actually start adopting some of these things. Okay, so last thing I want to talk about that I've been working on is disclosures. So I've been interested for a long time in privacy disclosures, as I've mentioned. And privacy disclosures come in all sorts of forms, including privacy policies and icons and nutrition labels and even games where you can learn about privacy policies. But there are lots of other types of disclosures, including actual nutrition labels. And then there's been this whole flurry of things that are not nutrition that want nutrition labels. And so the FTC has labeling facts. Broadband facts is the newest one. I mentioned this in one of the workshops yesterday. The FCC put out broadband facts recently. And my understanding is that they had no budget and very little time, and they had to come up with something. So they said, well, it worked for nutrition. We'll just copy that format. It's got to work for, like, bandwidth, right? And so that's out there. We also have disclosures about advertising, what is advertising on a search engine or on a news article, and then disclosures about things like how to wash your clothes, dry cleaning. That turns out that's something the FTC does too, which I didn't know until I got there. And in talking to people involved in all of these different efforts, one of the common things that comes up is that they're all, like, really hard for people to use. Nobody understands those dry cleaning symbols or whether it says dry cleaning. Do you have to dry clean it or is that just a suggestion? I don't know. Most people don't know, right? So there is great interest at the FTC in trying to figure out how to improve these things and how to test whether they're any good. And so we've been talking about, you know, what are the testing criteria. I kind of put together a list of things we might look at. So to start with, you know, do people notice that it's even there? Like, if you don't see the icon, well, then you can't be learning anything from it. If there's text, do people actually stop and read the text? Do people understand what they're reading, or is it full of jargon? Does it convey useful information? And does it lead to any behavior change? And is there a role for mediators? You know, it may be that most people don't read it, but there may be activists or journalists who read it and convey that information. So we're holding a workshop on September 15th at the FTC to discuss these things. And I invite any of you who have been involved in evaluating disclosures to think about submitting something. The deadline is July 15th. Feel free to come talk to me about what you think you might submit and whether it would be appropriate. We'd love to hear from you. We also have other opportunities for you to come talk to us. So on the agenda has already been announced, we're doing a ransomware workshop on September 7th. We're going to do a drone workshop on October 13th. Smart TVs, and especially the privacy issues associated with smart TVs, December 7th. And then PrivacyCon, January 12th. This will be our second PrivacyCon. Here's a picture from last year. There's Serge up there speaking at PrivacyCon last year. This is an opportunity to present your policy-relevant privacy research. It's not a publication venue, so you can present research that's been previously published or research that is not yet published. So do consider submitting something to PrivacyCon. Another thing that I've been doing at the FTC, and this is the last thing I'm going to talk about here, is I've gone around to every division of the agency and asked them, what research would help inform your work? And this has been actually a really fascinating project. And I've met a lot of people. I've learned a lot of things that I didn't know the agency did, like dry cleaning labels. And I have lots and lots of notes about what kind of research would be useful. I've then gone through and I've been distilling those notes and trying to find the commonalities, because I do, in fact, see the same things being brought up across different divisions. And so I'm in the process of putting together this kind of FTC research agenda. But here's kind of the high-level bits of what the FTC is interested in. And I'm going to highlight the first four. So disclosures and labeling I just mentioned. Very interested in privacy and security. There's some topics in investigation and enforcement, and consumer and business education. But besides all that, which is probably most relevant to the Soups community, we also have interest in ads and marketing, financial technologies, every community, which is basically the FTC wants to have an impact on every community, whether you're new immigrants, the elderly, veterans, disabled, whatever, we want to have an impact. Antitrust, tools and techniques, and then emerging technologies like 3D printers and drones and connected cars. Okay, so let me just talk quickly about these first four items. So disclosures and labeling, besides how to evaluate, we're also interested in things like what are the pros and cons of short notices and icons as opposed to the full long notice? What are user perceptions of notices and disclosures? How do they influence behavior? How can we use automation, computer-readable disclosures, to help in this case? And what are the role of mediators? In security and privacy, we're very interested in understanding and quantifying privacy and security. We want to know how consumers value different aspects of privacy, what their privacy expectations are, the impact of data breaches and privacy exposure. How do we assess risk and harm associated with these breaches? How do consumers balance privacy against other interests that they might have? And then attack trends and responses. In investigation and enforcement, this one's kind of interesting. So as I said, we have this whole division of people who are looking at these consumer complaints and what we want to investigate and enforce. But we know that only a small fraction of people actually complain. So what is it that we can do to get more people to file complaints and to file more useful complaints to us? How can we improve our user interface? And how can we figure out who we're missing? Are there communities who never complain and we're completely missing the problems that they face? We also have a division that focuses on consumer and business education. And besides the tweets and the blog posts, they have videos, they have games, they have pamphlets that they distribute at senior communities. They're very interested in having that evaluated. Some of this could be a great class project for those of you who are faculty, looking at some of these materials and trying to figure out, are they effective? How can they be made more effective? And what else can the FTC do to communicate? We also have things that we've been saying for years about how to not fall for certain kinds of scams, whether they're on the phone or phishing, and people still are falling for them. So what else should we be doing so that people don't fall for these scams? How many of you are Canadian? Okay, Canadians. Just last week, I was on a panel with the Canadian Privacy Commissioner, and he wants feedback too. So besides the FTC, Canadians want feedback. They just put out a document on consent and privacy, and how do you do consent for privacy better. So they want your feedback. They want your feedback actually fairly soon, by July 13th. So check that out on the Canadian Privacy Commissioner's website. So I was on a panel at CHI on public policy, and one of the issues that came up is that there are a lot of HCI people who are interested in doing public policy-related work, but then they feel like they write research papers and they can't get them published. So we had that discussion, like, why can't you get this published? Why does it keep getting rejected? And so we talked about, in the CHI call for papers, there's a list of contributions, things that a reviewer can say, yes, this is a good contribution, we should accept this paper. And we talked about, hey, how about adding public policy contributions? So we talked to the CHI 2017 technical paper chairs, and they agreed to add that. So that is going to be part of CHI 2017 call for papers and something distributed to reviewers. And basically, it's going to say that a public policy impact is something that helps us understand public policy impacts in areas related to CHI that are either the impacts of a law or policy on people or the impacts of technology or design on a policy goal, like privacy or accessibility or whatever. And of course, at SOUPS, we've had a number of great examples of policy-related papers, and I expect in the future, SOUPS will continue to be a great place to submit your policy-related work. So that's it. Please take a look at the tech blog. All of the things I mentioned, the FTC, you can find pointers to in the tech blog. And feel free to talk with me the rest of the week or to email me. Thank you.
All right, I think we have time for maybe two short questions. And please use the
So with all this process,
No, because we can only install software that is officially approved, and I don't think we have any officially approved password managers. So unless you like cheat and do it on your personal device, yeah. So there are a lot of people who write passwords down, which I think is the right thing to do in this situation. And it was funny, I was talking to an attorney, and she admitted to me that she wrote passwords down, and she felt really bad about it. And she says, I locked them in my desk, but I know it's not the right thing to do. And I said, well, no, actually, that is totally the right thing to do in this situation. If you're writing them down and locking them in your desk, that protects against most of the threats that we'd be worried about. So, yeah.
Hi, that was awesome. So I just want to ask a favor. Can you come to Navy and get them to stop our password expiration policy? I would like to support the fight, so how do I enact that? I guess the real question is, how do I enact that kind of change, where it matters? Because I have to reset my password every 60 days, and it has to be like 18 characters long with a ton of, it's terrible. And in it, I end up with essentially successive passwords that look a lot like previous passwords. And
Well, so I would say you should send them both a copy of my blog and the proposed NIST guidance, which both say why this is a bad idea. Schedule a meeting with them, discuss it. You're not too far away from DC, so maybe I could stop in for a visit. All right, thank you.